Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual. And Jim, we start with the good. A couple days ago, the good martini was that we looks like we might win one of the Colorado recall elections against two state senators that were targeted for recall because of their votes for strict gun control legislation out in that state. Senate President John Morse is the one we thought we might be able to get recalled. That was successful, but actually by a narrower margin than against the other state senator, Angela Guerin. She was easily recalled, 56-44%. Not surprisingly, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is accusing the GOP somehow of voter suppression. But Jim, we saw it after the crime bill passage, right before the 1994 Republican Revolution. People really don't like when their lawmakers target their Second Amendment rights, and Colorado proved it again.
When you have a big, surprising news event like this, it does kind of reveal quite a bit, Greg. And one of them is that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, like, it's now reflexive to say, well, there was voter suppression. They have yet to demonstrate anyone who wanted to vote and who could not. It's not like there wasn't any publicity for these elections, you know. It's not like there were lots of people. This was really obscure. And, oh, by the way, the anti-recall crowd outspent the pro-recall crowd by about 6-1. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is really not big on answering questions. And then when you do answer questions, she tends to ignore the question that was asked and give the answer that she wants. But basically to say, look, where was this suppression you're talking about? You guys had pretty much every advantage going into this, and you lost. The only thing you had working against you were the issues and the sense that these two state senators had gone too far to the left for their district, most notably on the issue of the Second Amendment and gun rights. Now, another kind of intriguing consequence or fallout from this comes from Public Policy Polling, a polling institution that is affiliated with Democrats, mostly works with Democrat campaigns, but got a lot of attention. They do a lot of polling, and I've cited their numbers in the past. But just this morning, they're saying that actually they had a poll over the weekend which showed Guerin being recalled, a 12-point spread that matched the actual results. You're thinking, well, gee, why didn't we hear about that? The answer is because they withheld it. They figured there's just no way that could be right and made the rare decision not to release the poll. It turns out we should have had more faith on our numbers, said pollster Tom Jensen. Now, that's his explanation, that it just looked wrong to him and he didn't want to explain it and turned out to actually be, you know, quite accurate of the final results. You could also say, no, this is a Democratic pollster who doesn't like the result he gets and feels that if he puts it out there, Democrats will be disappointed, dispirited, fearful, you know. Bigger and more broadly, the Second Amendment is getting a big shot in the arm of adrenaline today. The advocates have to feel energized. The folks who want to push for gun control felt a chill down their spine from this result, suggesting that actually no, public opinion is not on their side. And then, in fact, gun owners and Second Amendment advocates are more passionate, are more likely to turn up for circumstances like this. And not that surprising if you look at the history of the gun control debate, but in fact, lots of Democrats seem to get surprised by this time and again.
Quick addendum to the good martini. It was also primary day in New York City. To no surprise, Anthony Weiner did horribly. He finished with 5% of the vote. Also going down was Eliot Spitzer in his race to be the Democratic nominee for Comptroller of New York City. He lost 52-48% to Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer. We don't know for sure if Bill de Blasio avoids the runoff or whether there will be a Democratic runoff. Either way, Anthony Weiner won't be part of it. His deranged behavior throughout this campaign, but really towards the end, just shows that this guy's dealing with major problems beyond his political issues. And I honestly think, Jim, that he probably cost Eliot Spitzer his race, too.
There's a certain argument to that, that basically Spitzer's scandal was a little further back in the rearview mirror. You could say a few years back he had been in the public eye as a host of television shows on CNN and on Current. It's not like people felt warm and fuzzy towards Eliot Spitzer, but he could have, you know, perhaps more plausibly made the, oh, I've learned from my mistakes argument. Weiner hasn't really done much other than be a stay-at-home dad and kind of, you know, putts around as a lawyer. And so you're kind of left wondering that the sense that he was running out of boredom or out of a sense that he didn't know what else to do with his life. And his scandal was much fresher in the public eye. I think that both of them had rather sordid and twisted scandals. I think we can say that Weiner's was more bizarre, thinking back to, you know, Andrew Breitbart hijacking the press conference and laying out all the evidence and stuff like that. So Wiener, between the two, Wiener seems like a more thoroughly repulsive person. You all remember Nixon, you know, making his victory signs, you know, when he went into the helicopter after he left the White House. Well, Wiener offered the middle finger to reporters as he left his event yesterday. So a fitting end to the Wiener saga, and good riddance. A couple molecules that say, I hope he gets his life together and finds something else to do with his life, because he's put his wife and his child and his family and anybody who ever loved him through just way too much pain and aggravation and suffering and humiliation and all this. So hopefully he stays out of the public spotlight.
All right, on to the bad and the crazy, and that takes us to the president's speech on Syria last night. Here's the president talking about the extent of the carnage wrought by the chemical weapons in Syria.
The images from this massacre are sickening. Men, women, children lying in rows, killed by poison gas. Others foaming at the mouth, gasping for breath. A father clutching his dead children, imploring them to get up and walk.
The president then saying, we don't do pinpricks, but we can be quite effective with a limited strike. He did not use the words unbelievably small. And then he said this about the question of whether Assad needs to go.
I don't think we should remove another dictator with force. We learned from Iraq that doing so makes us responsible for all that comes next. But a targeted strike can make Assad or any other dictator think twice before using chemical weapons.
Jimmy conveniently left out what he did in Libya in terms of removing dictators and being responsible for the aftermath, potentially, including Benghazi, which is the one-year anniversary of today. But kind of a odd case there, so powerful on the effects of the weapons, and then perfectly content to leave Assad in power. I know you're probably a little bit more upset about that than I am, but it was an odd combination there.
Yeah, I mean, some of these comments will be for our bad martini, and some of these comments will be for our crazy martini. I'll focus on what I think was bad about the president's speech last night. The irony is that, as I tweeted last night, I actually don't think this was a bad speech. I think there were several sections that were actually quite powerful. A lot of folks on Twitter didn't necessarily like that assessment. My point was that, look, Obama spoke with quite a bit of passion and quite a bit of convincing detail about the horrors of what Bashar Assad did. He gassed children. Anybody with a beating heart in their chest looks at that and says, that is a barbaric outrage that deserves a response. And then the pivot to, so we're pursuing a deal with the Russians that will keep Assad in power. You cannot compare, as John Kerry did, compare Assad to Hitler and then turn around and say we might be able to work out a deal with him. It's unbelievably disconnected there. So I think, you know, probably Obama did himself more damage. The reason this is bad for us is that it's bad for the country to be seen as contradictory and conflicted and confused and all that stuff. Because it sounded like they had, you know, that all the comments about the slaughter of the children in Syria, which was, as I said, very powerful and I think very accurate, goes from we make that case and then it feels like they slapped a new section on because it got overtaken by events. And I don't quite understand why the president should make the case for striking out at a brutal man, an evil man, and then say, well, we might not do it. It doesn't make sense, and perhaps that'll be my most natural segue to our crazy martini, which was that Obama gave the speech at all, considering how the previous 24 hours had been one dramatic change in the Syria conflict after another.
Yeah, and here's a couple of clips that just leave you scratching your head. First of all, there's this clip of him taking credit for the diplomatic potential that's out there.
In part because of the credible threat of U.S. military action, as well as constructive talks that I had with President Putin, the Russian government has indicated a willingness to join with the international community in pushing Assad to give up his chemical weapons.
It wasn't productive talks. It was John Kerry's flippant offhand comment that he said had no chance of working. Here's the president talking about the importance of Congress getting involved in this and then the fact that we don't need them anymore.
So even though I possess the authority to order military strikes, I believed it was right, in the absence of a direct or imminent threat to our security, to take this debate to Congress. I have therefore asked the leaders of Congress to postpone a vote to authorize the use of force while we pursue this diplomatic path.
So, you know, he makes the case for war, but we're not going to do it. I'm calling this because I want you, the American people, to support this. But we're not going to have a vote, so don't call your congressman. It keeps going, you know, going around in circles here. it was kind of odd to see them announce several days ahead of time the president will be addressing the country. And we all kind of steeled ourselves, or we were all ready for the president to make what we kind of would say a more traditional address to the nation. We can probably think of George H.W. Bush addressing the country before the Persian Gulf War, George W. Bush during military action during his presidency. By the way, for some reason, President Obama does not like to do speeches in the Oval Office, which is the first weird thing. He keeps doing the East Room and have himself standing. Fine, whatever. But the second thing was that he was trying to advocate for a military conflict that he no longer seemed to want to pursue, that appeared to be overtaken by results, and it seemed to be, you know, like that Putin was two steps ahead throughout the entire negotiations. By the time the administration figured out how to respond to some sort of development, there would be another development either in Damascus or in Moscow or at the UN that would change these things. Because last we heard, the Russians did not want the UN Security Council to pass a resolution that would say that if Syria did not cooperate with this deal, there would be military consequences. So it sounds like there's an agreement as long as there are no consequences. Well, then it's not really much of an agreement now, is it? You know? So what we have here is a situation in which Damascus doesn't want the U.S. to bomb it. Obviously, you know, the Assad regime doesn't want that. Putin doesn't want that. And Putin wants to basically humiliate Obama and the United States as much as possible. President Obama isn't really sure if he wants to bomb Syria. But clearly, this is a guy with some serious doubts about this. I think, you know, from the way the president spoke about it, I think Obama the father wants to unleash hell on Assad. I think Obama the president is terrified of the political consequences because the American people don't want to go to war in Syria. The American Congress doesn't want to go to war in Syria. And with the exception of France, there's no indication that any of our allies are really willing to make any serious contribution to a war in Syria. So everyone's going to go along and pretend that we could set up an inspections regime in a civil war area. And I have a couple of posts on Campaign Spot this morning kind of laying out the logistical near impossibilities of that, just for sheer security, never mind getting UN folks and groups in, you know, safely into the area. I mean, they had people shooting at UN inspectors a month ago in that country. How you're going to, you know, find, locate, and then destroy chemical weapons, which is, by the way, apparently a very complicated and expensive, time-consuming process that, you know, here in the United States, we use robots for this sort of thing. We do not have people because the process of destroying chemical weapons is dangerous. Now imagine trying to do that in a country with an ongoing civil war. This is basically an idea that it has about a 1% chance of working, but everybody's going to put all their chips on it because they really don't want to go to war with Syria. And if the president, the country, the Congress, and no one really wants to go to war in Syria, then don't go halfway and don't propose it and don't say that this is an option. And then don't draw red lines you have no interest in seriously enforcing.
Obviously, two very important anniversaries for our country today. 12 years ago, 9/11. Last year, Benghazi. We certainly remember those today. We remember those impacted, their family members, and we're still looking for answers, especially on Benghazi. So we'll be focusing on that, hopefully, in the days ahead as Congress comes back. But it's important for this country to pause and reflect on the greatness of America and what it means to have that greatness attacked as it was on this day twice now in the past dozen years.
Indeed, Greg.
So we'll hold it there for today. Jim will be off tomorrow, but there will be a three martini lunch on Thursday, and then Jim and I will return on Friday for the three martini lunch as well. Have a great day, everyone.